Good morning. If you have a Bible, if you would please turn to 1 Samuel chapter 17. 1 Samuel chapter 17. We're going to spend quite a bit of time in this chapter this morning. We appreciate your presence here today. If you're visiting with us especially, we appreciate the interest in spiritual matters that you demonstrate by setting aside time on this Lord's Day to come and to be with God's people. If you do have any questions about anything that is said or done here at this place, we'd love to have the opportunity to sit down and to study the Bible with you and to talk to you about those things that we believe to be so important in our service and our worship to our God in heaven. He was a young shepherd. The Bible doesn't tell us how old he was. It simply refers to him as a youth. He was the king's musician. He had been anointed by Samuel to be the future king of Israel. By God's hand, he had already at this time in his life killed a lion and killed a bear. But this young man was about to come against the greatest opponent that he had ever faced. An opponent who, by our standards, would have been over 9 feet tall. He would have had armor that weighed the equivalent of 150 pounds. The spearhead alone that this warrior carried weighed 20 pounds. Of course, we are talking about David and the Philistine warrior Goliath. I think probably this is a familiar story to Christian and non-Christian alike, but I'm afraid that far too often we may have kind of put this story on the back shelf in our minds as something that is reserved simply for children. And we have failed to see the powerful message that it tells all who would seek life. You see, David was about to come face to face with a giant who, by the world's standards, could not be defeated. We all in our lives will face giants. But as in the case of David, through faith in God, he found the power to be able to overcome that which was undefeatable. In our life, it may be that we face a giant of some physical hardship. Maybe there's an illness in our life that has just debilitated us. Maybe there's something in a relationship that we have that is not what it ought to be. Or maybe we're facing, as so many at this time in our economy, some sort of financial difficulty. Or maybe there's an emotional giant that we just can't seem to overcome and to conquer. It seems something that is undefeatable. Or maybe there's a spiritual giant that we are facing with. There's some temptation that we can't seem to overcome. There's some struggle that just can't allow us to serve God as we ought to. Could it be that our life is without purpose, without hope, or without the value that we ought to have, where we can see the meaning in life? I'd like for us this morning to look at this beautiful story that the Holy Spirit has preserved for us about David and Goliath, and see 7 lessons that it teaches us to help us come to understand, as is said of this great battle against David and Goliath, the battle is the Lord's. The first lesson I'd like for us to look at is that we must never be discouraged when we face an enemy that seems to be overpowering. Read with me, if you would, in 1 Samuel chapter 17. Let's read together the first 11 verses to set up this beautiful story for us. Now the Philistines gathered their armies together to battle and were gathered at Socoh, which belongs to Judah. They encamped between Socoh and Azekah in Aphis Damim. And Paul and the men of Israel were gathered together, and they encamped in the valley of Elah and drew up in battle array against the Philistines. The Philistines stood on a mountain on one side, and Israel stood on a mountain on the other side, with a valley in between them. And a champion went out from the camp of the Philistines named Goliath from Gath, whose height was 6 cubits and a span. He had a bronze helmet on his head, and he was armed with a coat of mail. And the weight of the coat was 5,000 shekels of bronze. And he had bronze armor on his legs and a bronze javelin between his shoulders. Now the staff of his spear was like a weaver's beam, and his iron spearhead weighed 600 shekels, and a shield bearer went before him. Then he stood and cried out to the armies of Israel,
and said to them, "Why have you come out to line up for battle? Am I not a Philistine? And are you the servants of Saul? Choose a man for yourselves and let him come down to me. If he is able to fight with me and kill me, then we will be your servants. But if I prevail against him and kill him, then you will be our servants and serve us." And the Philistine said, "I defy the armies of Israel this day. Give me a man that we may fight together." When Saul and all Israel heard these words of the Philistine, they were dismayed and greatly afraid. You can well understand why it might be that they were afraid. In many respects, this saves the hassle of a battle, in that one champion is challenging them to produce another champion that could go up against them. This would spare the lives of many of the men rather than engaging in battle. But the problem is that this particular champion that the Philistines set before Israel is not your average champion. Instead, he is one that terrified even the king of Israel, that terrified all the men of Israel. They didn't have a champion that was of this kind of stature, at least so they thought. And so they were afraid. You know, it may be that as we look at things in our life, we have the same kinds of fears. We may sometimes look at things as they appear with the eyes and imagine that we don't have what it takes to be able to conquer and defeat that giant. See, the Israelites probably had the same problem because they had missed something that even the great Samuel, the prophet that God had sent to the Israelites, had himself missed on one occasion. Go back one chapter in your Bibles to the incident in which we learn about how Samuel is first introduced to David. I want you to notice with me in 1 Samuel chapter 16. Begin with me in verse 1. And I want us to notice what God tells us about the anointing of David, even before this event where he goes into battle against Goliath. Read with me beginning in verse 1. It says, "Now the Lord said to Samuel, 'How long will you mourn for Saul, seeing I have rejected him from reigning over Israel?'" You see, Saul, though he was the appointed king of Israel, had at least on two occasions sinned against God. In the battle with the Amalekites, he had not annihilated the Amalekites. He had spared some of the best to sacrifice. He had spared the king. But then also, he had offered an unlawful sacrifice. When Samuel had told him to wait and Samuel would offer it, he went ahead and was impatient and he offered it. And so God had rejected him. Notice it goes on to say, "Fill your horn with oil and go. I am sending you to Jesse the Bethlehemite, for I have provided myself a king among his sons." And Samuel said, "How can I go? If Saul hears it, he will kill me." But the Lord said, "Take a heifer with you and say, 'I have come to sacrifice to the Lord.' Then invite Jesse to the sacrifice, and I will show you what you shall do. You shall anoint for me the one I name to you." So Samuel did what the Lord said and went to Bethlehem. And the elders of the town trembled at his coming and said, "Do you come peaceably?" And he said, "Peaceably, I have come to sacrifice to the Lord. Sanctify yourselves and come with me to the sacrifice." Then he consecrated Jesse and his sons and invited them to the sacrifice. So it was when they came that he looked at Eliab, one of Jesse's sons, and said, "Surely the Lord's anointed is before me." Now, I don't know what it was about Eliab, Jesse's older brother, that apparently was impressive enough to Samuel that when he saw Eliab, he thought, "Oh, this is the one. This is a kingly person. This is a warrior, so to speak." Yet I want you to notice verse 7. "But the Lord said to Samuel, 'Do not look at his appearance, at his physical stature, because I have refused him. For the Lord does not see as man sees. For man looks at the outward appearance, but the Lord looks at the heart.'" What an important lesson that is. And we'll go on to look at the rest of it here. But think about the impact of that statement. It is not always what we can see with our eyes that is what is impressive and pleasing to the Lord. It is not always what appears to the eyes to be a matter of strength and prominence and dominance But instead, the Lord sees much different. The Lord is capable, as we are not, of being able to see the hearts of a man or of a woman, and to see strength that lies therein, to see character that lies therein, and in this case, to see a noble character that would in fact rise to become king of Israel. And in this situation, we'll look at in a few moments, rise to defeat this undefeatable enemy. Notice, so Jesse called Abinadab and made him pass before Samuel. And he said, neither has the Lord chosen this one. Then Jesse made Shammah pass by and said, neither has the Lord chosen this one. Thus Jesse made seven of his sons pass before Samuel. And Shammah said to Jesse, the Lord has not chosen these. You ladies that have had children, can you imagine? Eight children, apparently, and maybe even some more. But here are the sons that passed before. Verse 11. Samuel said to Jesse, are all of the young men here? Then he said, there remains yet the youngest, and there he is, keeping the sheep. And Samuel said to Jesse, send and bring him, for we will not sit down till he comes here. As the youngest in my family, I'm always pleased with this. It's the young little boy that's out with the sheep that hadn't even been brought before Samuel. And yet, he's the one that they're waiting on. Verse 12. So he sent and brought him in. And he was ruddy with bright eyes and good looking. And the Lord said, arise, anoint him, for this is the one. And Samuel took the horn of oil and anointed him in the midst of his brothers. And the Spirit of the Lord came upon David from that day forward. So Samuel arose and went to Ramah. Now get that picture in your mind as you think about what we're going to read about back in chapter 17. This is one that all the other brothers looked to Samuel as if they should be the one. And yet it was the youngest, the one that was with the sheep. The one that, in our text, was not even initially sent out to battle. He stayed back home to take care of the sheep. And yet, this will be the one that the Lord uses. Before we look further at our account, turn over to Matthew chapter 7. And I want us to bear something in mind, because it may be that in our life, we are not facing physical giants in the same way that David did. But when we name the name of Christ, we are set against an adversary that often may seem to be insurmountable. We are at odds with a world that has great objectives to destroy and defeat those matters of truth. And we need to understand that when it comes to how we evaluate strength and weakness, what is acceptable, what is not, how we evaluate what will be victorious and what will fall by the wayside, cannot be with the eyes either. In Matthew chapter 7, in verses 13 and 14, remember what Jesus said, enter by the narrow gate, for wide is the gate and broad is the way that leads to destruction, and there are many who go in by it, because narrow is the gate and difficult is the way that leads to life, and there are few who find it. A second lesson, though, that I think we must glean from 1 Samuel chapter 17 is that we must not allow the enemy to speak evil of God. Back in chapter 17, I'd like for us to read together now. Skip down to verse 22 through 26, and let's read as the story continues. And David left his supplies in the hand of the supply keeper, ran to the army, and came and greeted his brothers. In the text in between that we skipped over, David's father Jesse sends him with supplies for his brothers that are here at the battlefront, that are there ready to engage in battle with the Philistines. He arrives there. He gives the supplies to them. And then he goes to see what is going on with the battle. And as he talked with them, there was the champion, the Philistine of Gath, Goliath by name, coming up from the armies of the Philistines. And he spoke according to the same words. So David heard them. What words did he hear? We read them at the beginning of our lesson. That defiance of the armies of the God of Israel, defying them to send out a champion to fight against him. David hears that now. Verse 24. And all the men of Israel, when they saw the man, fled from him and were dreadfully afraid. Now, you would think that this young boy that had not even been sent off to battle, if there'd be anyone that would run trembling away, it would be a little boy that had been left at home. And I say little boy, he may well have been a young man at this stage, but you might think that he'd be the one. But much different reaction is what we'll see. So the men of Israel said, "Have you seen this man who has come up? Surely he has come up to defy Israel. And it shall be that the man who kills him, the king will enrich with great riches and will give him his daughter and give him his father's house exemption from taxes in Israel." And David spoke to the men who stood by him, saying, What shall be done for the man who kills the Philistine and takes away the reproach from Israel? For who is this uncircumcised Philistine that he should defy the armies of the living God?" I am so amazed by the righteous indignation of this young man. Because here, he may not be a warrior in the sense that his brothers were. He may not have been trained in battle as they were. But he knows enough when an enemy of God's people comes before them and defies not just the people of God, but defies the God of Israel. He is upset. It angers him. I want us to think about that for just a moment when we think about our own responsibility. I realize that all around us we live in a world in which there are those that will speak evil of the things of God, that will mock and defy and will ridicule those that are trying to do right, will in fact go so far as to speak evil of God. And that should upset us. That should not be something that we just get used to hearing. But I want us to think about a little bit different angle with respect to blaspheming the name of God. It should bother us when we hear people speak evil of God and speak evil of the things of God. But you know what should bother us much more? Is when our own lives allow the name of God to be blasphemed. Read with me, if you would, in Romans chapter 2. Romans chapter 2. Begin in verse 17 and go down through verse 24. Paul, after talking about the sinfulness of the world back in chapter 1, in chapter 2, then directs his attention to those who would have been Jews, that should have been the people of God, that should have been faithful to God, and yet far too often were hypocritical. Romans chapter 2, beginning of verse 17, notice it says, "You indeed who are called Jew and rest on the law and make your boast in God and know His will and approve the things that are excellent, being instructed out of the law." Now understand, he's probably talking to those in Rome that had come out of a Jewish background and now had obeyed the gospel and yet perhaps were being hypocritical. Notice, "and are confident that you yourselves are a guide to the blind, a light to those who are in darkness, an instructor of the foolish, a teacher of babes, having the form of knowledge and truth in the law. You, therefore, who teach another, do you teach yourself? You who preach that a man should not steal, do you steal? You who say, 'Do not commit adultery,' do you commit adultery? You who abhor idols, do you rob temples? You make your boast in the law. Do you dishonor God through breaking law?" Now notice verse 24. "For the name of God is blasphemed among the Gentiles because of you, as it is written." It is one thing for us, like David, to be upset when there are those that will verbally blaspheme the name of God and defy the people of God. But it's even worse if by our behavior, our hypocrisy, we cause the name of God to be blasphemed. Go back to 1 Samuel chapter 17 as the third lesson that we must understand back in 1 Samuel chapter 17 is that we must never be turned by those who would sway us from doing what is right. 1 Samuel chapter 17, let's read continuing in verse 28 and go down to verse 32. "Now Eliab, his older brother," remember, this is the one Samuel looked at initially and thought, "Surely the Lord's anointed is before me." Well, what role does he play in this story right now? "When his older brother heard, he spoke to the men, and Eliab's anger was aroused against David. And he said, why did you come down here? And with whom have you left those few sheep in the wilderness? I know your pride and the insolence of your heart, for you have come down to see the battle. And David said, what have I done now? Is there not a cause? Then he turned from him towards another and said the same thing. And these people answered him as the first ones did. Now, when the words which David spoke were heard, they reported them to Saul, and he sent for him. Then David said to Saul, let no man's heart fail because of him. Your servant will go and fight with the Philistine. I want you to notice here, the easy thing would have been for him in the face of even his older brother's rebuke, his older brother attributing some sort of pride or insolence to him. Easiest thing for him might have been to say, well, you know, that's not what I'm trying to do. I'm not trying to be arrogant here. But he sees a bigger picture. He understands the people of God are being challenged here. The cause of God is at risk. And so he will not even allow that kind of circumstance to deter him. We need to recognize that in the world around us, there are those that stand not only against the things of God and the people of God, but there are those that certainly would try to make it seem as if our efforts to do right are suspect, or our efforts to do right should be ridiculed. Back in Romans chapter 1, in the chapter that I mentioned that addresses the sinfulness of this world, I want you to notice just a little something. Romans chapter 1, beginning in verse 28, as it describes the attitude of the world around us. Verse 28, and even as they did not like to retain God in their knowledge, God gave them over to a debased mind to do those things which are not fitting, being filled with all unrighteousness, sexual immorality, wickedness, covetousness, maliciousness, full of envy, murder, strife, deceit, evil-mindedness. They are whisperers, backbiters, haters of God, violent, proud, boasters, inventors of evil things, disobedient to parents, undiscerning, untrustworthy, unloving, unforgiving, unmerciful. Now notice verse 32. Who knowing the righteous judgment of God, that those who practice such things are deserving of death, listen to this, not only do the same things, but also approve of those who practice them. Isn't it so bizarre that we live in a world today in which you do wrong and you will get scores of people that'll be right there with you, cheering you on, telling you that's acceptable, that's what you ought to do. But on the opposite end of the spectrum, you do right and there are those at every turn that would try to discourage you, try to mock you, try to sway you from doing what God would have you to do. Turn over to 1 Peter chapter 4. 1 Peter chapter 4. In fact, things so often get turned upside down. The things that are right are viewed as if they are wrong, and the things that are wrong are treated as if they are honorable and noble. But this is the way it's always been. In fact, this is the way that the Holy Spirit reveals that God's people will be viewed. 1 Peter chapter 4, read with me in verses 3 through 5. Notice, for you have spent enough of your past lifetime in doing the will of the Gentiles, when we walked in lewdness, lust, drunkenness, revelries, drinking parties, and abominable idolatries. Listen to this. In regard to these, they think it strange that you do not run with them in the same flood of dissipation, speaking evil of you. They will give account to him who is ready to judge the living and the dead. You know, Eliab was ready to ascribe impure motives to David. And yet that wasn't what it was at all. There will be those around us that are going to think it strange that we want to be faithful to the Lord, that we want to live a life that is in obedience to the Word of God. But notice there in verse 5, they will give an account. Proverbs chapter 14, verse 19 says, fools mock at sin, but among the upright there is favor. A fourth lesson we want to learn from 1 Samuel chapter 17 is we need to remember how it is that God overcomes evil. We have a tendency sometimes being Texans especially, we have a tendency to think that, things have to be accomplished through big efforts. We have a tendency to think that it's the big things that are the way that you can attain victory. Now, if you're talking about a physical battle, I'd rather have a big gun than a little gun in a battle. But understand, God doesn't see things the way we see things. And God can bring about victory in a way that's different than the way physical victory would be accomplished. We need to remember that evil is overcome by small and simple things of God. 1 Samuel chapter 17, I'd like us to read together. 1 Samuel chapter 17, verses 33 to 37. And Saul said to David, "You are not able to go against this Philistine to fight with him, for you are a youth, and he is a man of war from his youth." But David said to Saul, "Your servant used to keep his father's sheep. And when a lion or bear came and took a lamb out of the flock, I went out after it and struck it and delivered the lamb from its mouth. And then when it arose against me, I caught it by its beard and struck and killed it. Your servant has killed both lion and bear, and this uncircumcised Philistine will be like one of them, seeing he has defied the armies of the living God." Moreover, David said, "The Lord who delivered me from the paw of the lion and from the paw of the bear, he will deliver me from the hand of this Philistine." And Saul said to David, "Go, and the Lord be with you." Now, I find this very interesting because David recognizes what so often we miss. And that is that the power doesn't rest within ourselves. Now, I understand that often when we'll hear people talk about that, we see almost kind of an attitude that says, well, it's all of God. It's none of me. I don't have to do anything in obedience to God. No. If we understand that the power rests in God, everything must be done in service to Him. Our will must be surrendered. We must wholeheartedly give ourselves to Him, understanding it's not that I can figure things out. He's the one who's revealed Himself to me. I must do what He tells me to do. David had this attitude that recognized it wasn't his great skill in being a shepherd. It wasn't his great skill in fighting against a lion. It was the Lord who had delivered him. I think we need to recognize the same sort of thing. Turn over to 1 Corinthians chapter 1. 1 Corinthians chapter 1. When it comes to spiritual things, let's not make the mistake of so many in the world and think that bigger is better. Think that it's got to be mighty and it's got to be impressive with the eyes. Understand, as Paul will declare in Romans, there's a power that's contained in the message of the gospel. Listen to what Paul says in 1 Corinthians chapter 1, begin with me in verse 18, where he talks about the real power of God, how it is that victory comes about. Verse 18, "For the message of the cross is foolishness to those who are perishing, but to us who are being saved, it is the power of God. For it is written, I will destroy the wisdom of the wise and bring to nothing the understanding of the prudent. Where is the wise? Where is the scribe? Where is the disputer of this age? Has not God made foolish the wisdom of this world? For since in the wisdom of God, the world through wisdom did not know God, it pleased God through the foolishness of the message preached to save those who believe." People will look at the message of Christianity and they'll say, "That's silly. You mean you serve a crucified master? You mean that you're teaching that being dunked in water accomplishes something? Or eating of the elements is some sort of memorial that means something?" It's foolishness to the world. Listen, verse 22. "For the Jews request a sign, Greeks seek after wisdom, but we preach Christ crucified. To the Jews, a stumbling block. To the Greeks, foolishness. To those who are called, both Jews and Greeks, Christ, the power of God and the wisdom of God. Because the foolishness of men is wiser, foolishness of God is wiser than men, and the weakness of God is stronger than men." In the next few verses, he goes on to talk about their own situation. The Corinthian church was not made of those that were mighty by the world standards. It was not that folks looked at them and were so impressed with them God had chosen the humble of the world to shame the mighty. Verse 29, that no flesh should glory in His presence. Go back to 1 Samuel chapter 17. The fifth lesson that we must learn is we need to be sure that we come to the battle with our armor on. Now, if you know the story of David, that may seem a little unusual to you, but I want you to notice 1 Samuel chapter 17, continue in verse 38 and go down to verse 40. So Saul clothed David with his armor, and he put a bronze helmet on his head and also clothed him with a coat of mail. David fastened his sword to his armor and tried to walk, but he had not tested them. And David said to Saul, I cannot walk with these, for I have not tested them. So David took them off. Then he took his staff in his hand, and he chose for himself five smooth stones from the brook and put them in a shepherd's bag in a pouch which he had, and his sling was in his hand, and he drew near to the Philistine. Now, I said, be sure that you wear your armor, but you got to make sure you've got the right armor on. David couldn't use Saul's armor. I don't know if it was just simply that it was too large for him, or the term that's used here, he hadn't tested them. He wasn't accustomed to working in that. It would not have been what it would have given him victory. But what gave him victory was that those smooth stones, that sling. And doesn't that tell us something about the source of power? It's not in the things that are impressive, not in the things that you might imagine bring about victory. Turn over to Ephesians chapter 6, and isn't this exactly what we as Christians need to understand? Our victory over the giants in our lives will not come about through some kind of worldly wisdom. It will not come about through those things that the world might imagine to be a source of strength. Instead, listen to Paul's words in Ephesians chapter 6, beginning in verse 10. Finally, my brethren, be strong in the Lord and in the power of His might. Put on the whole armor of God that you may be able to stand against the wiles of the devil. What is this armor of the Lord? Verse 13. Take up the whole armor of God that you may be able to withstand in the evil day, and having done all to stand. Stand therefore, having girded yourself with truth, having put on the breastplate of righteousness, having shod your feet with the preparation of the gospel of peace. Above all, take the shield of faith with which you will be able to quench all of the fiery darts of the wicked one. That's the armor we need. It is like those smooth stones that David had. It may not seem impressive to the world, but it can bring down giants. Sixth lesson, back in 1 Samuel chapter 17. Through God's power, we can have confidence in the very face of evil. 1 Samuel chapter 17, verse 41. So the Philistine came and began drawing near to David, and the man who bore his shield went before him. And when the Philistine looked about and saw David, he disdained him, for he was only a youth, ruddy and good looking. Imagine this picture. You've got a 9-foot-tall man in armor coming against this young man. He's not afraid. In fact, verse 43, so the Philistine said to David, am I a dog that you come out to me with sticks? And the Philistine cursed David by his gods. And the Philistine said to David, come to me and I will give your flesh to the birds of the air and the beasts of the field. Now, would that intimidate you? I'm going to tell you, if I'm standing up against a 9-foot-tall man in armor that's cursing at me by his gods, my natural inclination will be to tremble and to be afraid. But look at David. Then David said to the Philistine, you come to me with a sword, with a spear, and with a javelin, but I come to you in the name of the Lord of hosts, the God of the armies of Israel, whom you have defied. This day the Lord will deliver you into my hand, and I will strike you and take your head from you. This day I will give the carcasses of the camp of the Philistines to the birds of the air and the wild beasts of the earth, that all the earth may know that there is a God in Israel. Then all the assembly shall know that the Lord does not save with the sword and spear, for the battle is the Lord's, and He will give you into our hands. I want you to notice here the great courage that David had. Here, as he goes against this intimidating foe, one in which he might well have imagined, and others would have imagined, there's nobody that can overcome this man. David speaks to him with such courage. David has such confidence. David is convinced that God is the one that will grant victory. We need to remember that same thing. The power of God does not rest in things that are before the eyes. Romans chapter 1 and verse 16, the gospel is the power of God unto salvation. In the same way that we can put our confidence in the gospel as the means to overcome any adversary, we need to see exactly what David did as he stood before Goliath. We need to understand what David understood. Turn over, if you would, to 2 Peter chapter 2. 2 Peter chapter 2. God's able to deliver. He has always been able to deliver against adversaries. This beautiful passage in 2 Peter chapter 2 talks to us about a number of times throughout God's dealings with man in which He has done exactly that. He has delivered us. He has delivered against enemies. 2 Peter chapter 2, beginning in verse 4. For if God did not spare the angels who sinned, but cast them down to hell and delivered them into chains of darkness to be reserved for judgment, and did not spare the ancient world, but saved Noah, one of eight people, a preacher of righteousness, bringing in the flood on the world of the ungodly, and turning the cities of Sodom and Gomorrah into ashes, condemned them to destruction, making them an example to those who afterward would live ungodly. Notice, and delivered righteous Lot, who was oppressed by the filthy conduct of the wicked. For that righteous man, dwelling among them, tormented his righteous soul from day to day by seeing and hearing their lawless deeds. Listen to this. Then the Lord knows how to deliver the ungodly out of temptations and to reserve the unjust under punishment for the day of judgment. One final lesson will bring our lesson tonight, this morning, to an end. Back in 1 Samuel chapter 17, we need to see the end of the story. In 1 Samuel chapter 17, verse 48, so it was when the Philistine arose and came and drew near to meet David, that David hurried and ran toward the army to meet the Philistine. And David put his hand in his bag and took out a stone and the sling in it, and struck the Philistine in his forehead, so that the stone sank into his forehead, and he fell on his face to the earth. I wish that I could have an audio of this event, because I can almost imagine armies cheering on both sides, and the two come together, and yet you hear that thud of a stone in the forehead of this giant. And I can imagine silence. You could hear a pin drop, I would suspect. Because the very thing they would not expect to happen, before armor even clashes against armor, this man drops like a rock with a rock in his head. So David prevailed over the Philistine with a sling and a stone and struck the Philistine and killed him. But there was no sword in the hand of David. Therefore, David ran and stood over the Philistine, took his sword and drew it out of its sheath and killed him and cut off his head with it. And when the Philistines saw that their champion was dead, this was the last thing they expected. They thought they'd be marching triumphantly towards Bethlehem or towards other Israelite cities. And their champion lies with his head in the hands of this young shepherd boy. They fled. Verse 52. Now the men of Israel and Judah arose and shouted and pursued the Philistines as far as the entrance of the valley and to the gates of Ekron. And the wounded of the Philistines fell along the road to Shamarim, even as far, isn't this interesting, as Gath, the very hometown of this giant and Ekron. Then the children of Israel returned from chasing the Philistines, and they plundered their tents. And David took the head of the Philistine and brought it to Jerusalem, but he put his armor in his tent. Turn over to James chapter 4 as we bring our lesson to a close this morning. James chapter 4. We need to remember something when we stand against giants in our life. Certainly there are those things that we may face that seem to be overpowering, seem to be quite threatening. But just as Goliath and the armies of the Philistines, in a moment of time prior to this, felt as if they were victors, when that defeat came, the enemy flees from victory. In James chapter 4, we have a powerful admonition that is given to us as we face those giants in our life. We need to recognize that Satan, though he'd love to overpower us, and sometimes it may seem as if he gets the best of us, when we remain faithful to the Lord, he eventually will flee from us. James chapter 4, beginning in verse 7. Therefore, submit to God, resist the devil, and he will flee from you. Draw near to God, and he will draw near to you. Cleanse your hands, you sinners, and purify your hearts, you double-minded. Lament and mourn and weep. Let your laughter be turned to mourning and your joy to gloom. Humble yourselves in the sight of the Lord, and he will lift you up. Beautiful, powerful lesson to us. The battle doesn't belong to the enemy. The battle is the Lord's. The challenge for you and I, though, is to make certain that we put ourselves on the right side. To make certain that we put our confidence in the right source. It may be that you're here this morning and in those battles that you face, you've been defeated and you haven't even realized it. But if you are in sin, you need to recognize that your sin separates you from God. And you are standing up against a giant that you cannot defeat on your own. A giant that one day on the day of judgment will lead you to be eternally separated from God in a place of punishment forever. But God loved you enough that he sent his Son to die for you and I. That if you would but put your faith in Jesus as the Son of God, confess that faith before men, repent and turn away from sin that is defeating you and separating you from God, and be baptized into Christ for the remission of sins, the Lord will add you to his people. You'll be on his side. You'll be on the winning side. If as a child of God, you started well, but somewhere along the way, those giants of life have defeated you, the Lord gives you an opportunity continually to go to him and request forgiveness. To go to him in the presence of your brethren, where you can have co-workers and soldiers in the same battle that will pray to God on your behalf to help you get back up so tomorrow you can conquer that giant. If we can help you, won't you come? Always stand and sing.